This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. World leaders gathered this week in London for a NATO summit. What was said off mic attracted as much attention as what was said on mic. The House steps up pressure on China for its treatment of Uyghurs. Ukraine asks Apple why Crimea shows up on Apple Maps as being part of Russia. And who has shown up again in Ukraine? Rudy Giuliani. Plenty to talk about today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us around the table are Ron Nixon, International Investigations Editor for the Associated Press and the author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
David Lawler, World News Editor at Axios. Welcome, David.
Great to be with you.
And Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National, a news site that specializes on reporting about the Middle East. Joyce, glad to have you back.
Hi, Josh.
Glad to have your questions and thoughts as well about the top stories from around the world. I know we've been super focused on impeachment this week and a little bit on NATO. We're going to talk NATO in a minute, but there's much more going on around the world that we think you should know. So send us your questions. Email us 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. As I said, lots been going on with NATO. We talked about it as a team and we decided we wanted to start with Iran. We'll get to NATO in a minute, but things have been bad in Iran for a while and we think they deserve more attention. Now, last month, to set off a huge budget deficit and a weak economy, Iran's government jacked up the price of gas. And then protesters clashed with security forces and they set government buildings on fire and banks on fire and they blocked roads. Amnesty International has put the death toll at around 200 people. But this week, Brian Hook, who's the U.S. Special Representative for Iran, told reporters that the regime may have murdered more than 1,000 people.
Among those murdered are at least a dozen children, including 13 and 14-year-olds. We have received reports from family members of victims who tried to recover the bodies. The authorities demanded that the families first pay the cost of the bullets they used.
That was Brian Hook, the U.S. Special Representative for Iran. Joyce Karam, let me start with you. What do we know about conditions inside Iran right now?
I mean, there was an internet blackout when the protests were going on. We know from the U.S. side what Brian Hook yesterday, this is a very high number, if it's true. But again, there is discrepancy in numbers. The U.S. now is putting it at 1,000. Amnesty said 208. New York Times said as high as 450. So we don't know exactly what's the exact death toll inside Iran, but this is looking pretty dire. You know, whatever the number is, it's much higher than 2009, where you saw 72 died in were killed in those protests. From what we see is basically the regime, the Iranian regime, is still committed to the same tactics that had kept it in power since 1979, which is a heavy crackdown, arrests. I think the arrests are definitely over 1,000, according to Amnesty. From the U.S. side, they're trying to capitalize on this. We saw also the meeting between Secretary Pompeo and Israel's Bibi Netanyahu. They criticized Iran. The risk here, the danger, is the U.S. taking credit for what's a very organic and an internal Iranian issue and making it about the Trump administration and the maximum pressure campaign.
Well, David, that's what I wanted to ask about in terms of why this is happening organically internally. Jordan wrote on our Facebook page, fuel price increases did this in France as well. People don't play around when it comes to energy. It's not a game. Is this about gas prices or is there more layered on top of this?
So it was a very significant uptick in gas prices, upwards of 50% for people paying at the pump. And this is a country that is an oil-rich country, and low gas prices were sort of baked into the equation. A lot of government services aren't particularly great, but low gas prices is something you got. So that definitely was a significant factor driving this. Obviously, Iran has been under sanctions for years now. Living conditions are getting more difficult in Iran, and there is, you know, in around the region, a backlash to government corruption. Iran is not the only country where people are in the streets talking about corruption. So there are regional factors at play here, too. But as Joyce said, from the perspective of the U.S., they have been trying to tell the world this regime is terrible And now they see these scenes in Iran and they see this as an opportunity to say, look, this is what this regime is all about. And so now it has become sort of a international, you know, geopolitical thing rather than just, as Joyce said, an organic protest movement.
Ron, how much of a role does the U.S. play in this? I mean, are the U.S. sanctions what kind of made this a tipping point? Is this more internal, as Joyce said, than external? What role is the U.S. playing?
It seems to be more internal than external. I mean, obviously, the sanctions do play a role here, and you can't really understate that they do play a role, but this seems to be more internal. But again, as both Joyce and David have made, that the U.S. Chiming in on it in the way that it has makes it easier for the regime to simply say that this is like an externally backed rebellion rather than this you know thing that just came up from the people inside the country, and it makes it you can point to these outside agitators, and make it so that the regime can distract from the fact that these gas prices have risen to the point that they have and the effects of the sanctions.
What about the impact, Ron, in terms of what drove the people to protest this intensely? I mean, they know how authoritarian the government in Iran can be.
Right.
Some of our listeners have been asking about the role of outside pressure. Mm-hmm. Barbara writes, isn't this the desired effect of the sanctions against Iran? Unfortunately, it is the population that suffers from sanctions. Any excuse for regime change?
Well, I don't think that's the stated goal of the sanctions, but it does have that effect. But I think what people also have to remember is that these are not things that just spontaneously happen just because of one incident or another. These things happen all the time there. I mean, they just reached a critical mass with the increase in these gas prices because, again, that really hurts in a country that is like oil rich.
Joyce?
And I think, too, you know, the Iranians that took to the streets, they see their government involved in spending a lot of money in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, and they kind of grew sick of it. They just they know this, as David said, very rich oil country, but now the gas, the price gas is up by 300%. So in that sense, I think there is a regional mood. You see it in Iraq. You see it in Lebanon against a growing Iranian hegemon in the region, and that's part of the driving force, not just the U.S. sanctions inside Iran.
Joyce, is this at all about trying to topple the regime? I mean, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel suggested that on Wednesday. He said, quote, "Iran's aggression is growing, but its empire is tottering," unquote. Is it?
I mean, that's, I think, if we can call it wishful thinking, probably, on the Israeli prime minister part. The regime is still very much in control inside Iran, and even regionally, they still have a lot of cards to play. The IRGC is going full force with the crackdown, and they sort of succeeded to a certain extent. So we haven't seen.
I'm sorry, the IRGC, the Iranian
Revolutionary Guard. So these are, you know, authoritarian regimes that operate on brutality, and sadly, it has worked for them. So, unless we see a major game changer here, I don't know how this would be the end of the Iranian regime.
Now, David, this came up during the UN summit. France and Germany warned that UN is developing nuclear-capable ballistic missiles that would put Tehran in breach of the Iran deal and of a Security Council resolution. And, of course, that also irked Benjamin Netanyahu. Here's what he said in a video that his office released on Wednesday.
While the Iranian regime is killing its own people, European countries rush to support that very murderous regime. While Iran bombs Saudi Arabia's oil installations, while Iran rushes to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons, European countries rush to appease Iran with even more concessions.
That was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel in a video that his office released Wednesday. David, what about that? Different European countries have different relationships with Iran. Some can do business directly, some can't do business directly. Clearly, Israel and the U.S. are not crazy about that. But is Europe actually going to be forced to change the way it does business with Iran?
they've been doing a very delicate dance with Iran ever since Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, which was a move that they disagreed with. They've basically tried to set boundaries with Iran, say we won't accept certain things, while still not trying to have that relationship break down entirely, because they think that, you know, their presence there is a check on Iran really breaking out of the nuclear deal, really making these kinds of moves. So they've really tried to balance those two interests in a way that has upset the Trump administration, which wants an all-out hard line on Iran, and obviously Netanyahu as well. For him, it's sort of inextricably linked to domestic politics. He is facing corruption indictments at the moment. There's a political crisis in Israel. So standing next to a top U.S. official and saying we're going to be tough on Iran is probably not such a bad thing for him.
And he does have a political faction that would support him very, very strongly if he does that.
That's right.
We'll continue the Friday News Roundup in a minute with David Lawler of Axios, Ron Nixon of the Associated Press, and Joyce Karam of The National. As we mentioned, there is a NATO summit this week. Diplomacy got a little undiplomatic. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But we are getting close to the end of this decade. And this week, Spotify released its list of the most streamed songs of the decade around the world. Third place was Rockstar by 21 Savage and Post Malone. Second place went to One Dance by Drake, Kyla, and WizKid. And number one, obviously Ed Sheeran, Shape of You. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you, and you are streaming or listening live to 1A from WAMU and NPR. Come on, be my baby, 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 come on. I'm in love with the shape of you, we push and pull like a magnet do, although my heart is falling too. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Ron Nixon, International Investigations Editor for the Associated Press, David Lawler, World News Editor at Axios, and Joyce Karam, Washington Correspondent for The National. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. One last question about Iran before we keep going. Actually, let me get to a comment and then a question. James tweeted, most of the victims in Iran were young and did not remember the brutality of the government during the last big protests 10 years ago. People who remember did not participate as much as those under 25 or 30. Question about Iran from one of our frequent flyers, Kokomo Kid, tweeted, isn't Trump complicit in the Iran mess by quitting the nuclear deal and enacting debilitating sanctions? David, what about that? How much of a role did the Trump administration play in this, what's going on now?
I think Trump would say, if you talk to him candidly, that, you know, an uprising in Iran is not against his wishes. So he might be complicit, but there's a reason they have sanctions on Iran, and it's to put the regime under pressure. And the regime is obviously under pressure at the moment.
Let's talk about the NATO summit. 29 world leaders convened in London for its 70th anniversary summit. Diplomacy is the name of the game, but things have been rather undiplomatic this week. You might have seen that video that circulated on Wednesday of a number of allies mocking President Trump during a candid conversation at a reception at Buckingham Palace. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in the group alongside French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Ron Nixon, they were basically kind of poking fun at the president for being late. And he's like, well, of course he's late. He does a 40-minute press conference.
Yeah,
like, is this really a thing? Or is this just the kind of thing that goes on and we just happen to have an open mic?
I think this is the kind of thing that goes on that just happened to be caught on the mic here. But what's significant, there's a couple of things that are significant about this. One, I think that the president thought that he probably had a closer relationship with Boris Johnson than to have him in on this gag about him being late. And, when he's talking to as Trudeau was saying, that staff's draws dropping to the floor.
Although Boris Johnson is up for, he's got an election coming up
does.
Next week.
He does have an election and is basically politely told the president to sort of stay away and not really to inject himself into the election. So to distance himself from President Trump. But again, I think that that's for a president who has, and both as a candidate and as president, talked about the world laughing at us, right? That's got to sting because they were literally laughing at him. And this is not something that he likes to be mocked, to have people laugh at him.
Now, Joyce, these world leaders all have, in their way, they've all got stress on their mind. You know, Emmanuel Macron is dealing with big protests in Paris right now. Boris Johnson is dealing with a snap election, which he may or may not win, to try to get his Brexit plan through. Justin Trudeau survived the latest election after some controversy, so he is finally kind of back in office for another term. But in retaliation, President Trump called Trudeau two-faced and canceled a news conference before coming back to D.C. Could this have some actual tangible impact, some real damage?
I mean, at this point, it just feels like a reality show, people gossiping at the palace, Princess Anne, all of that. But I mean, when you dig deeper, there are some good things ongoing for NATO, for example, and credit perhaps to the White House that they did get other countries to increase their spending. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing. They got a Baltic defense agreement, so that's also a good thing. So we have two things ongoing. On the one hand, you have this reality show, this Trump and Macron and Trudeau calling each other's names, but on the other hand, you do see a more cohesive agenda for NATO. Very high military spending and now military assurances for the Baltic states that will definitely, worry Russia. Now, of course, there are disagreements, too. We saw them come up between, mostly Trump and Macron, as you mentioned, on Turkey, on Russia, on other priorities for the alliance.
Well, but speaking of that, Joyce, one of the other tense moments of the summit happened when President Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron were talking about ISIS fighters who are currently imprisoned in Syria. Here's a clip of an exchange between them. It's about a minute long, but here's President Trump and President Macron.
We have a tremendous amount of captured fighters, ISIS fighters, over in Syria, and they're all under lock and key. But many are from France, many are from Germany, many are from UK. They're mostly from Europe. And some of the countries are agreeing. I have not spoken to the president about that. Would you like some nice ISIS fighters?
Look, okay,
I can give them
to you. Look at the situation.
You can take everyone you want.
Let's be serious. The very large number of fighters you have on the ground are ISIS fighters coming from Syria, from Iraq, and the region. It is true that you have foreign fighters coming from Europe, but this is a tiny minority of the overall problem we have in the region. And I think number one priority, because it's not yet finished, is to get rid of ISIS and these terrorist groups. This is our number one priority.
Those were French President Emmanuel Macron and President Trump. David, what do you make of this exchange?
A couple of things. I mean, first of all, you're seeing a much sterner, I guess, Emmanuel Macron when he's sitting down with Trump. It used to be that he thought they could be friendly in public and that
the
he
bromance.
Would pressure him behind the scenes to change things. That strategy obviously didn't work. Trump left the Paris Agreement. He left the Iran nuclear deal. So Macron has basically decided, buddy-buddy is not going to work. On this issue, I mean, you know, after this, Trump basically followed up by saying Macron's answer was the best non-answer he'd ever heard on whether he was going to take these ISIS captives back. Obviously, the European countries are not anxious to take back these captives from their home countries. But Macron's point will needle Trump a bit, too, because he said, you know, there's been destabilization in Syria, and that's causing an ISIS resurgence, which hits Trump on two fronts. One, he says that the ISIS is done, basically, is Trump's narrative. Macron's saying that's not true. And two, when he talks about destabilization, that has a lot to do with Trump, who pulled back from the border, Turkey moved in. And so, you know, these are two leaders who certainly don't see eye to eye on this issue.
Ron, Turkey is one of the big issues that's come up at the NATO summit and also among some of our listeners. Joe tweeted, "What has developed at this week's NATO meeting regarding Turkey's split allegiances with NATO and with Russia? There were issues surrounding Turkey purchasing Russian military equipment and differing opinions regarding the Kurds. Were there resolutions on these topics?"
I don't recall, and I have to admit I'm not as versed on this as probably like two panelists are, but the thing with Turkey is that Turkey does have the split allegiance and that they're trying to do it both ways, and that be allies with the Russians, but at the same time have a relationship with NATO and have a closer relationship with Europe as they are having these internal problems and a crackdown on the press and opposition there. So it's there's a lot of things going on, I think, with Turkey that is both international pressures and internal pressures that they're trying to navigate this so that they can, you know, keep things relatively stable at home.
Well, Joyce, one of our listeners, Simon, asked about how to navigate this. Simon writes, if America is withdrawing from a rising multipolar world, then isn't the quote, NATO is brain dead, not a joke? Should Europe be forming a foreign policy separate from America to curb threats like Russia and Turkey? Joyce, that quote refers to something Emmanuel Macron said in the last few days. But I think what Simon is suggesting is kind of the opposite of why NATO exists, so that you don't have to do this country by country, so you can have one big bloc that will act as a bulwark together against Russia.
I mean, sure, there is no unified vision, political vision yet for NATO. You do see a lot of internal disagreements. Russia doesn't want to emphasize, France doesn't want to emphasize the Russian threat as much as the other countries. Germany, too, doesn't want that. The U.S. wants more focus on China, but the Europeans are a bit reluctant. And to what Ron said on Turkey, Turkey is, you know, acting like the spoiled child of NATO. They want to have one foot in Russia, purchasing the S-400 missile system, and also, you know, keep buying the Western weaponry like F-35. So in that sense, that was on full display in London, and you saw Macron just, you know, questioning how could this happen, that we have a NATO member acquiring and soon activating a Russian missile system. So that's a dilemma that NATO has to address. There was another issue that Turkey tried to disrupt at this summit with the Baltic defense agreement, but then it caved in. Of course, after a private meeting between Trump and President Erdogan, and we don't know what was, you know, bargained or discussed in that meeting. So definitely a lot of disagreements.
So, David, what's the outcome of this summit? Was it productive? Was it just a bunch of undiplomatic moments between diplomats? Like, what's the final score?
I mean, I think Macron asked a very good question in his meeting with Trump, which was, if we're all going to get together and we're going to talk about budgets and we're going to talk about the future, but we're not going to talk about the fact that one of our NATO allies just bought a big missile system from Russia and just invaded Syria, what are we doing here? I mean, that was basically his question. And it's a pretty good one. I mean, yes, the alliance is spending more on defense, but there are big questions about what NATO stands for and what the purpose of this alliance is going forward. And
so why aren't they talking about it, though?
I think that a lot of these leaders think there's enough complications going on right now, and to have a big blow up over Turkey this week was just not what they wanted to do. I mean, Merkel chided Macron basically for raising some of these questions, saying I have
Angela
to go
Merkel
around,
of Germany.
Angela Merkel, right? Saying I have to go around picking up the pieces when you make these big, you know, broad statements. And so, yeah, there's real disagreements both on the future of NATO and what we should be talking about.
Is it really that toxic, Ron, of a topic, Turkey? I mean, they got, I'm walking right into a pun. They got to talk Turkey sooner or later.
Good pun. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is because, you know, again, as Joyce pointed out, you have a NATO member purchasing weaponry from Russia and at the same time purchasing weapons from European allies. And it's sort of thrown people for a loop. Like, what are you doing here? And why are we placating this country as it tries to have it both ways?
But no one wants to go up to them and be like, Turkey,
no,
like, dude, stop.
Well, I think there's a lot of factors there because there's so many other things that are just chaotic around that they're trying to deal with. And it's just one of many problems that they're trying to solve, you know, Iran and everything else in the region.
And they feel emboldened by, I think, right, President Trump. A lot of the stuff that Macron was saying, you hear it actually from senior right. U.S. officials. They're very frustrated with the White House policy, right. But it's like the president is running his own policy on Turkey.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Another story out of Europe we wanted to get to. On Wednesday, German authorities kicked two Russian diplomats out of Germany. Those men are suspected to be involved in the death of a man who was shot dead in a park in Berlin last August. The victim, the guy who was killed, was a former Chechen rebel commander. Now, Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov denied the accusation that Russia was involved in the killing. Russia's foreign ministry said it would take, quote, tit-for-tat steps, unquote, in retaliation. David, this may need a little bit of unpacking for those who have been following the whole Russia-Chechen rebel thing. Why does that matter?
So basically, I mean, the German authorities are not saying for sure that Russia ordered this person assassinated in a park in broad daylight in Berlin. But what they're saying is the Russians are not helping us investigate this. And they're saying the likely places where this was ordered are either in Chechnya, which is a region within Russia that has had, there's been wars over Chechnya in the not too, distant past. And so, this is a bit of a repeat of what we saw in the UK when there was a former double agent, Sergei Skripal, attacked with a chemical weapon there. Except this time, Germany is not really calling for a huge international reaction in the way that the UK was at that time. They're playing it a little bit, safer. But they, as you said, have kicked out two Russian diplomats.
So we don't know for sure what the motive was behind the shooting. Germany says that it's one thing and Russia is denying it.
Germany says either somebody in Moscow or Chechnya probably ordered this. We don't know for sure, but it's suspicious, I guess, that the Russians are washing their hands of it and not helping in the investigation.
Ron, what do we think Russia means by tit-for-tat steps? Like, what kind of retaliation are we talking about?
I mean, the typical retaliation that you would see, expelling diplomats or, maybe cutting off some trade relations with them. So far, we haven't seen anything that indicates that they're going to do that. But a lot of this seems to just be saber rattling for because Germany dispelled the two diplomats. But what you also see here is that Russia says that this guy was, as a terrorist. And he had survived assassination attempts before. And this is something that Russia has been accused of around the world, of assassinating political opponents. And so, again, as David said, it's been a little more subdued than what Theresa May did when there was the attempted assassination in the UK. So right now, it just seems that Russia is engaging in a bit of saber rattling. Well, and we haven't seen any indication.
Well, and to that, Joyce, before we pause, after the attack on Sergei Skripal, like, clearly that didn't stop anything.
Right.
Like, I'm not sure whether that changed the equation at all.
Yeah, but credit to Theresa May, they acted very fast. In the case of Germany, they waited 4 months to do something. The Germany expelled two diplomats. The UK expelled 100. Yeah. Russian diplomat. So it's very different cases. And I do have to send also a shout out to Bellingcat, great investigative journalism that uncovered the identity of the guy, the true name that led to what we know today. Now, in the case of Germany, it has more interest with Russia. It seems it's trying to preserve, such as the Nord Stream pipeline, such as Merkel is looking to mediate with Ukraine pretty soon. So all of that puts it in a very different limelight than the UK.
One last comment on NATO before we move on. Jim writes, I don't think most people realize that NATO is protecting the US, not the other way around. If they've ever played Risk, they would understand this simple concept. That is a blast from my past. I have not played Risk in a while. But we will play on with the Friday News Roundup when we continue with Ron Nixon, David Lawler, and Joyce Karam. Rudy Giuliani's playing a bit of a dangerous game with one of the visits he took around the world this week. We'll get to that in a minute. And here is another one of Spotify's top artists, this decade's most streamed female artist, Ariana Grande. We'll listen to a bit of her now and keep going with the Roundup in a minute. Stay close. Back now to the roundup with Ron Nixon, David Lawler, and Joyce Karam. Still time to get in some of your questions and thoughts. 1A at WAMU.org. Tweet us at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. So Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, traveled to a number of European countries this week, including Ukraine. Media reports have called that a surprise visit. Ron, do we know anything about why he's there and whether it has anything to do with the whole Ukraine thing?
Yes, we do. So Giuliani is supposedly in Ukraine to meet with some former prosecutors as well as some current ones about the Biden investigation that is at the center of the impeachment against President Trump for asking the Ukrainians to look into a potential political foe that is former Vice President Joe Biden and current Democrat running for the president. So he's supposedly there as part of this documentary that would show how the impeachment inquiry against President Trump is drummed up by the Democrats, which is an odd time to be in Ukraine to be working on a documentary about the impeachment inquiry while the inquiry is going on. And meeting with the very people that sort of kicked off the impeachment in the first place. Mm. I mean, it's really odd timing. And even some people in the GOP are scratching their heads like, you know, this is really the wrong time to be in Ukraine at the time, because we're trying to make the point that, you know, this whole thing is not what's being sold to the American people by the Democrats. And here you are, maybe doing the very same thing that they've accused you of. It's trying to dig up dirt on President Biden.
Well, and Joyce, on top of that, you know, Ukraine's got a lot of other things to worry about right now. Like the Ukraine scandal and the impeachment inquiry is what matters to the U.S. But Ukraine is still in a hot war with Russia. They're still, Crimea is still contested territory. So I'm sure that this just adds more unwanted attention, more unwanted drama to a nation that's already got like life or death issues to deal with right now.
Oh, no, of course. And it's you know, as Ron said, I don't think Giuliani is there sightseeing or, you know, skiing. There is also the aspect that here is, you know, the president's lawyer that doesn't make time to appear in front of Congress, but has time to go to Ukraine, follow up on an investigation about him in Congress. So it's not a good look. And for Ukraine, yeah, as you said, they're trying to just keep distance from the whole investigation and not, drag themselves into it.
David?
And actually, the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, actually said this just this week. He said, you know, Trump keeps saying we're a corrupt country in order to deflect this impeachment thing. But we're trying to raise investment. We're trying to build partnerships around the world. And the president of the United States, who's supposed to be our biggest strategic partner, keeps going around telling everybody we're corrupt. So, yeah. So there are implications for them.
I can only imagine if Rudy Giuliani went just to go skiing. I didn't know. Let's go back to NATO for just a minute and talk about climate change. The UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, also known as COP25, started this week in Spain. It was supposed to take place in Chile, but there are ongoing protests there, so they moved it to Madrid. Nearly 25,000 people from 200 countries are there. So basically the whole world is represented. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi appeared. Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old climate activist from Sweden, was there. Also, the World Meteorological Organization released its annual report on the state of climate change this week. David, are there any particular highlights from the meeting, either from that report or other big issues that are being addressed?
So we have just lived through the hottest decade on record, which is probably not that surprising, given that it seems like every year we're living through the hottest year on record. So the numbers we're seeing just keep getting worse. You know, the message from the people who are doing the science is basically we need to cut carbon farther and faster every year. And so the big question is, does the political will exist from these countries who gathered in Spain to actually do more than most leaders, except for President Trump, perhaps, and a few others, come out and say, this is a priority for us, this is something we're doing. But you know, when you have to make sacrifices economically, are they willing to take those steps?
Well, Ron, in terms of the international political will, I think the Paris Agreement kind of demonstrates that there is the international political will. The U.S. under the current administration...
We've pulled out of the Paris
Agreement. Right. The U.S. Under the current administration has pulled out of that. Right. But it seems like these reports are having an impact in some way. Greta Thunberg basically shaming the whole U.N. had an impact. Right. So I don't know. I'm less pessimistic now than I was like 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, I think that a lot of the other countries are obviously taking it more seriously than the U.S. because, you know, President Trump has said on some occasions that he thinks climate change is made up and that it's a Chinese plot or something. And you know, the U.S. is one of the biggest carbon emitters, along with China. And China is actually, you know, taking on a much larger leadership role in this area than you would have thought. You would have thought the situation would be reversed with the U.S. doing this. But I think there is more of a sense of urgency by other countries as a result of what's happening. You know, as David said, we continually have these hottest decades on record. And there are real results. I mean, there are real impacts on the ground. There are some countries where, even here in the U.S., you know, there are real impacts on the ground from climate change. So there has to be something that is done. And I think other countries are just looking as the U.S. sort of abdicates its leadership role in that to step up France. In particular.
And that's another leadership role that China steps up on, which kind of raises its profile on the world stage in general.
Right, right.
Speaking of China, let's talk about China. There's a few stories related to China and Asia we wanted to touch on right quick in the time we have left. Joyce, this week the U.S. House approved sanctions on certain members of the Chinese government for the way that China has treated the Uyghur Muslims. Remind us what's been going on with them and what this response is. What is it that makes these sanctions significant?
I mean, it's first because it was passed with 401 votes in the House, so that's an overwhelming majority from both parties. It means it's most likely going to pass in the Senate, and it's another opportunity for President Trump to pressure China on the Uyghurs issue. We're talking about around a million people, you know, being trapped in camps in 2019. That's you know, shocking in itself. But also, it comes also after the Hong Kong Democracy Act that President Trump signed 10 days ago. So in that sense, we're seeing pressure, more tension building up between the U.S. and China. And there are concerns in the long term if you want the two big global powers, two big global economies to walk into such confrontation. If the Uyghurs bill passes the Senate with, 90 votes, then obviously the president will have to sign it, because even if he vetoes, if he does the veto power, it will pass again in the Senate. So,
with regards to that pressure and the tension with China and the pro-democracy bill, David, the president did sign a piece of legislation last week that supports Hong Kong's pro-democracy protests. This week, China responded to that. It banned American military warships and aircraft from making stops in Hong Kong. What does all of this mean for the ongoing tensions between China and the U.S.? We've already got this trade war going on. Now there are military vehicles that are being blocked from Hong Kong. This feels like an escalation on both sides.
First of all, China hates this stuff. The naming and shaming stuff on the world stage, they react aggressively when that happens. We've actually seen, there was a letter that was written, signed by several countries, saying we're concerned about, the internment of all these Uyghurs. And then they got a list of mainly dictatorships to sign a letter saying China's doing great stuff to fight terrorism. They really care about how this stuff plays out, especially in international organizations.
Wait, they got a letter signed by dictators telling the world that China's not acting dictatorially.
Yes, and there was no irony at all from the Chinese side in doing this. North Korea was one of the signatories that said it's all good what they're doing in Xinjiang. Well,
they're a trustworthy arbiter of this kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. But what it does show you is that there were all these countries who were willing to sign that letter, many of them in the Muslim world. I mean, these are mainly Muslims being locked up in Xinjiang. China uses its economic might to really intimidate countries and to, you know, basically say you have to choose between doing business with us or criticizing us. And everybody except for the U.S., which is the biggest economy in the world, not everybody. I mean, there are European countries speaking out, too. But this is rare. I mean, you don't see many parliaments around the world passing this kind of rebuke of China.
And if I just may add, this also comes in the aftermath of this leak of this trove of documents from China about the treatment of the Uyghurs. Confirming things that the Chinese have always said that, no, that's not true, that these are just vocational camps. You know, these are not internment camps. These are just vocational camps that keep people skills and things. But the documents seem to confirm a lot of what's been said before.
Speaking of North Korea, Ron, North Korean state media said this week that Washington would get a Christmas gift this year. The hell is that supposed to mean? That does not sound good.
I have to pass it off on my colleague.
Do we know what they meant by a Christmas gift, David?
Yeah. So they've had this end of year deadline. Basically, we need to make progress on you reducing sanctions on these nuclear talks by the end of the year, or else, basically. We're talking about some sort of test, I think. Right. I mean, there's the idea that they might return to sort of longer range missile testing, which they've put on hold. Basically, they're returning to insulting Trump as well. They've started to call him out by name. So we are seeing things go back from sort of the warmer phase we were in to this very hostile relationship between the United States and North Korea.
Didn't seem much like a gift, though.
No.
It didn't seem like another love letter to Trump.
Right. No. Certainly not. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. One relationship that is growing is between China and Russia. And Joyce, China's president Xi Jinping and Russia's president Vladimir Putin launched a gas pipeline on Monday, 6,000 miles long. It's got to be significant, obviously, economically, because it provides another gas pipeline. But geopolitically, Russia and China getting closer together, Joyce, that's got to have big implications.
No, it is. And the project itself is very significant. CNN said it's the most significant energy project for Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. They're also planning Russia, China, and Iran naval exercises soon, on December 13. So we're seeing a much closer relationship. We're seeing a booming trade between the two countries. And then they're trying sort of to create their own alliance against the U.S., whether it's in its policies in Europe or in the Middle East. So in that sense, it's not surprising. President Xi called President Putin his best friend. It's just unclear how the U.S. will navigate around these challenges and friendships, especially when it comes to its interests in, on the energy front and in Asia.
David, I could be wrong about this, but it seems like China and Russia are trying to kind of make more friends and alliances around the world in the last few years. I mean, there was that summit of about a month ago where the leaders of Russia, Syria, and Turkey all attended. China has been doing a lot more business in Africa, investing billions and billions and billions of dollars in infrastructure projects. It feels like the two of them are building alliances around the world, and now they're allying with each other. And this is not by accident.
Right. They're doing it in very different ways, though. China is a rising power with a lot of money, and so they are building infrastructure all over the world. There are these big investments from China. Russia's partnerships are mainly on, the military side or occasionally on the energy side. And that also, is a factor of their relationship between Russia and China. This is going to be fascinating to watch in the coming years because China is emerging as a superpower. Russia is right next door and is not. They're a stagnant economy. I mean, they're not developing these new, you know, technologies of the future. And so that relationship is going to become increasingly imbalanced between Russia and China. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays in Russia going forward.
Meanwhile, Ron, for us in the U.S., you know, some of our biggest concerns with China have to do with like apps like TikTok and whether or not they're spying on us. I mean, CNBC reported this morning that the chief of TikTok is going to meet with lawmakers here in D.C. next week.
Right. I mean, you know, they're doing this charm offensive the same way that Silicon Valley has done as they come under more scrutiny.
But that's no minor thing. Between TikTok, Huawei, we've been hearing more about this.
Right, because there is good, you know, there have been a number of national security concerns raised about both, you know, Chinese software and Chinese apps that are used, that, you know, that these companies would give the Chinese government access to this personal information. And so, again, I think that this is a charm offensive in the same way that Zuckerberg came to talk about Facebook's influence.
One last story before we go. We've got all this international intrigue in the real world. Finally, some news from the file marked License to Kill.
The world's moved on, Commander Bond.
You were 00?
2 years. So stay in your lane. You get in my way, I will put a bullet in your knee. The one that works.
I like her already. No Time to Die, the new James Bond movie. The trailer dropped this week. It will be Daniel Craig's last appearance as 007. No word so far on who will succeed him. There are rumors that it might be a woman. The action is guaranteed, but don't expect the sexism of the past. At Daniel Craig's request, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who's the star of the comedy Fleabag, gave the script a once-over and added what she dubbed some little spices. Those spices include more humor, more character depth, and omitting some of James Bond's chauvinism. Thanks to Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National. Joyce, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
David Lawler, World News Editor at Axios. Thanks, David.
Thanks so much.
And Ron Nixon, International Investigations Editor for The Associated Press. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Do check out the 1A podcast if you can. The roundup sounds great at the weekend as well. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. If you write us a review, we'd be honored. You'll find all the links to listen at the1a.org. 1A senior producers are Daniel Knight and Paige Osborne. Miranda Fulmore produces our daily podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.